Ads, schmads. If you don't want ads, that's okay. Choose the Dave McWilliams Plus option on Apple Podcasts. And hey presto, no ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? We are giggling here on... Well, it's not St. Patrick's Day. St. Patrick's Day is over. But we're going to have, as Eliza calls it, our Seachtain na Gaeilge. Seachtain lá féile pórach, okay? Which is because, again, in the States, there will still be going on and on about it over the next couple of days. It is St. Patrick's Week. This is an Irish podcast. You are coming from the epicenter of all things Irish, which is Dunleary. Not, but actually it's a version of Ireland, okay?
The place that voted for unionism
the last in place, 1918. The last place in the Republic of Ireland that voted for unionism here in Kingstown. Anyway, it is good to have you here. I hope you enjoyed Paddy's Day and I hope you didn't get too messy. And I hope it was actual fact. I realized that it's so much better crack abroad than it is here.
Yes, yeah. I've been to the Paddy's Day Parade in New York a couple of times, actually. And actually, now that you mention it, I think I was there in 88, 87, 88, something like that, when it was the first time that the gay Irish community marched in the parade. And there was a big hullabaloo made about it. And I was over there with Bannum, Pete Bannum, who's now the marshal.
Who's now our representative in Utah, exactly, the grand marshal.
But we found the group walking down because we wanted to support them.
Yeah.
And the abuse from some people down Fifth Avenue was amazing. And you know the way they pass by St. Patrick's Cathedral?
Yeah.
And the bishop is there and the archbishop and all these fellas with collars and pointy hats all stood up and turned their back. I was shocked and ashamed.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing about Irish America is that it reflects Ireland, which is, in a way, which was then very, very...
An old Ireland, I think.
Was very, very homophobic. And now it's gone the other way.
Yeah.
Now it's gone the other way, you know. So to where the conservatives feel that they are in a minority.
Yes.
You know, so it is interesting, but it's true that certainly in London over the last couple of years, St. Patrick's Day has become a much, much bigger event, much, much bigger than when we were there years ago. It's always been a big event. But what it is, John, it is an expression of soft power. And I know that certain of us don't see it that way, but the notion that you have this one day where an enormous amount of people who are not Irish are of not Irish descent, celebrate Irishness, even if it is in a sort of a Hollywood Disneyized version, it is something quite phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna read you. You know, you think St. Patrick's Day is a reasonably recent idea. Mm. You know the way, for example, the Victorians invented tartan to create an image for Scotland, right? It was actually entirely...
Entirely
invented. And lots of people say, oh, I presume St. Patrick's Day is the same thing. It's an invented notion of Victorian age, but it's not. And I'm going to quote you something.
Oh,
here.
Okay.
Here's an extract from the journal of Thomas Dinnelly, Esquire, giving some account of his visit to Ireland in the reign of Charles II. So this is the late 17th century.
Wow,
it's a long, long time ago. And this is it. It's written in all ye olde English thingy. And he said, the 17th day of March yearly is St. Patrick's, an immovable feast when ye Irish, of all stations and conditions, were crossed in their hats, some pins, some green ribbons, and the vulgar superstitions of wearing shamrocks, three-leaved grass, which they likewise eat, they say, to cause sweet breath.
Oh, okay.
Now he goes, this is in a visit to County Clare.
Right.
The late 1700s, right? The common people and servants also demand their Patrick's groat from their masters, which is some money, right?
Right, okay.
From their English masters, which they go expressly to town, though half a dozen miles off, to spend, where sometimes it amounts to a piece of eight, or cob, or piece, and very few of the zealous are found sober at night.
Right, okay. So not much has changed then.
So not much has changed, but what it means is that Paddy's Day is a very, very old celebration here. It's very, very old. So if in, you know, the 1700s, these guys were talk English visitors were talking about it. It's a very, very, very old custom.
But see, I always thought that this was a brilliant piece of marketing by Bord Folger that they reintroduced in the 50s or 60s
or whatever it is.
Really, like I am surprised at that.
Yeah, so was I. But I mean, it's when you have the evidence.
Yes, yeah. Well,
of Dinley Esquire in.
Am I to contradict Dinley?
Yes, Esquire. Look, so think of it, Charles II of England ruled England, Scotland, and Ireland. From the Restoration in 1660, the Restoration of the Monarchy, after they cut the other fella's head off, right? Until 1685. So we're talking a long, long time ago, the late 1600s, Irish people were celebrating. I love the fact that we ate shamrock to sweeten our breath after a rake of pints, right? But it is a very, very old celebration. But to look at it in the global context now, I have always believed that the diaspora, the tribe, as I like to call them, the tribe outside, are a massive, massive, massive resource that we don't use properly. And the reason I think they're a massive resource is because you've got this notion of hard power, right? That's the power of, Putin is a great example of hard power, right?
Yeah.
You know, you are absolutely dominant in physical violence, in diplomacy, in being taken seriously because you force other people to do your bidding.
Yeah, yeah.
Soft power is when you persuade other people to do your bidding. When you exist in people's heads, where there's a notion of you that resides in a person's head. It's like marketing, advertising, yeah, it's branding.
Branding.
It's all branding, right? So if you look at St. Patrick's Day, what it does do is it actually reanimates the brand of Ireland, which is a fun brand, it's a joyful brand, it's a giggly brand, doesn't take itself too seriously, and it's associated with good times. And it's associated with people who are largely liked around the world, right? Yeah. And these things are unbelievably potent when it comes to real economics. When I talk about real economics, I'm talking about industry, I'm talking about manufacturing, and I'm going to talk about what we're going to talk about today, the creative industries, and specifically film and TV, simply because there has been so much success.
Oh, it's been phenomenal over the last while.
And of course, you know, Cillian Murphy capping the whole thing last week at the Oscars. So it's that idea. But what is interesting is that in the same way as Irish literature, you know, your Becketts, your Joyces, your Wilds, all those guys, right, from 100 odd years ago, what they did was in the English language, they gave the English language an Irish accent. It wasn't that they wrote in their own language. In fact, people would argue that a lot of the death of the Irish language was due to when Daniel O'Connell started to speak in English to try and agitate for nationalism, not in Irish. And the reason he spoke in English, because he wanted to persuade English liberals to come on our side. But for what you have is, you know, whether it's the Sally Rooneys, whether it's the Paul Lynch's winning the Booker, all that sort of stuff, because, you know, I'm putting the Book Festival at Dalkey together now.
Yeah.
And the amount of Irish talent in literature at the moment is off the scale, right?
Yeah.
Now, what it does do is it reinforces Irishness through the English language in the brains and the minds and the imagination of other people. And again, it's very, very hard to quantify, but all of this goes some way to advancing the economic cause of the nation.
Yeah.
And I mean, the film industry is exactly that. What it does is it projects an image of Ireland or Irishness into an international stage.
Yeah.
So you're in people's living rooms. And when you're in people's living rooms, you're in people's heads. And that's the really important part. And that's the crucial part about branding.
Apart from Far and Away with
Nicole
Kidman and Tom Cruise.
Do you know where I saw that, John?
That should be out of people's heads.
No. In actual fact, we should actually rerun that. I saw that in the Forum in Glastool. Do you remember that?
I remember
which has
that.
Now become a Centra.
Yeah.
Which
yeah,
is a
yeah,
reflection yeah. of all things that are bad in Ireland. The Forum in Glastool.
Yeah, that actually just speaks volumes.
Right now, the Irish film and TV and animation sector, because don't forget animation, we have
animation
won Oscars.
Huge. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's all located in Kilkenny, which is amazing. But it's estimated to be worth 692 million euros per year. Okay, so half a billion. So it's a big industry.
Yeah.
11,000 jobs, indirect and direct. You know, basically, you've got everything from, as you say, sound engineers, you've everything from, you know, runners, you've all that sort of yeah. stuff, right? So it's a big industry. It's consistently been supported by the state, and it has to be. And the reason it has to be is that we don't have the capital base here to do that.
Yeah.
So in the United States, like when you go to Hollywood, remember I said I was in, you know, LA a couple of months ago, and I realized, wow, this is a city that lives on its imagination.
Yeah.
But it also backs imagination. So there's a huge pool of money for LA producers. Whereas here, you're trying to get money from all over the place.
You know, in the 80s, the Irish film industry was, you know, barely yeah. non-existent. But then they introduced these tax breaks. Well, explain those to me.
Okay, so it's a very odd thing. We're going to be talking to Ed Guiney, who is yeah. of Element Pictures, probably the most successful production company maybe in its field in the world at the moment. And it just won 4 Oscars for Poor Things, which I went to see last night.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about that in a second. But about 20 years ago, about 25 years ago, Ed rang me because I've known him for a long time. And they were like, said, look, David, we need to commission a report to advocate for Section 481, which was a tax break. See, what happened was for so many years, the cinema and TV industry argued for its existence based on culture, that this was an expression of Irishness and this was a unique expression of Irishness. And if we lose this, we lose that idea, that soft power. Yeah. But of course, what happened is in the Department of Finance, all the bean counters are looking at expenditure and saying, does that make sense? So I was asked by the independent producers to write an economic report to explain to the Department of Finance that there were all sorts of direct and indirect positives for supporting this, and that it wasn't going to cost them money, because Section 481, the whole way it works is that it's a tax break for investors. So if you have a surplus in your company, right, and you don't want to pay tax on it, you can invest it in cinema and get that tax break back.
Right.
And then, of course, the cinema creates its own, basically what they call in economics, multiplier effect. So the idea was that how much of a multiplier effect will there be in these industries? And what we calculated was about 1 in 6. So for every €1 right. spent, there was a 6 times multiplier
yeah.
over a number of years. And that was a report that I wrote for Ed and Alan Maloney and a lot of other producers that yeah. are now doing great stuff.
It fucking worked. Tax system works.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and adjusting the tax system works.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, on the one hand, you have this perception that Ireland is always tinkering around with the tax system and it's an unfair advantage.
Yeah.
But it's
not what you're supposed to do, though.
That's exactly what you're supposed to do. And yeah. it does work. But again, at the core, John, is this big, big discussion between what is the future of Irish filmmaking? Is it what I would call the factory model? Do we just get in as much production as possible? And we don't care who owns it. So what I would call it's the kind of the Google, Facebook, Intel model. What we've always done is we've said, you guys come in here, you set up Ireland as your production location. We will give you tax breaks. You will give us revenue. And we will create a stream of workers, employees to go yeah. in and yeah. work. So that's one way. Mm. But it's very fragile because it's fragile to all sorts of outside
You're beholden
events.
To them at the
yeah,
end of
and
the
you
day.
Don't, but the most yeah. important thing, you don't own the shit. So the key yes, to economic yeah. wealth is ownership. It's not participation. But what's interesting about Irish filmmaking now is it's moving much more towards owning the content. And when you own the content, that's when you create the value. And that's when you also create an industry of storytellers, of scriptwriters, of people who will sit down, who are very, very good at narrative, all that sort of stuff. And that's where the real juice is. So now, John, why don't we go and talk to an expert? Let's get the inside track on what's going on in the film industry worldwide and in Ireland with Ed Guiney of Element Pictures. Now, if you've been living under a stone, you might not have heard of the recent success of the Irish film industry, from actors to producers to directors to screenwriters to the whole gamut, has over the last couple of years been increasingly recognized around the world, winning awards, BAFTAs, Golden Globes, and of course, the big one, Oscars. Now, one man who is the co-director or co-founder of Element Pictures is a guy I've known for many, many years, Ed Guiney. I'll just give you a little bit, and I know Ed is going to be kind of embarrassed by this, but the roll call of Element successes. This is a Dublin-based production company, film production company, 26 Oscar nominations the company has received, 14 Golden Globe nominations, 37 BAFTA nominations, and of those Oscars, 6 wins. Of those Golden Globes, 2 wins, and of those BAFTAs, 10 wins.
Incredible.
So by a long, long stretch, possibly one of the most successful film and TV production companies in the world. And of course, you will know it from if you're watching the likes of Normal People and all sorts of things. And Ed is on the line. Ed, how are you? Lovely to see you.
Hi, David. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. I'm in flying form. I'm going to set the scene here because Ed and I know each other for a long, long time. It is November the 11th, 1987. And I remember the date particularly well because, John, because Ed, Ireland are hoping to qualify for the Euro 88 soccer tournament.
Always a football reference.
Always a football, right? And in order to get into... You people will not remember this maybe. In order to get into Euro 88, which would be our first ever international competition, first ever international competition, Scotland have to beat Bulgaria in Bulgaria, right? If they don't beat Bulgaria, Bulgaria go through. And a well-known comedian and actor called Gary Cook, who Ed will know well from our time in college, he and I go up to the Suffolk House when it was a little small boozer. And Gary demands that they put on BBC, or could even have been BBC Scotland, right?
Yeah.
Okay, to find this game, and Scotland win 1-0. So Gary and I realise that Ireland have just qualified first ever. So we come back into Trinity, and we're sitting in the arts block, and Ed and Leddy Abrahamson walk by with projectors and all the sort of machinery of the Trinity Film Society. Do you remember this, Ed? Years ago.
I don't remember it specifically, but I remember it generally.
Yeah, and we were chatting away, and of course, we were going into our final year, and we were saying, what are you going to do after you leave college? And I was like, I don't know. What are you going to do? I don't know. And Ed said to me, I'm going to make movies. And I said, how do you mean you're going to make movies? Nobody makes movies in Ireland. Because no, we can do it. We can do it. And Lenny said, yeah, and we can write them, we can direct them, we can do them. And the pair of you did it, which is extraordinary. 30 years later, the pair of you are at the Oscar. Extraordinary stuff, Ed. Amazing that you guys, I remember bringing cinema into Trinity in the 80s when nobody had the balls, the gumption, or the vision to even think about that.
God bless your memory. I mean, it's true that Lenny and I started kind of working together in Trinity. And yeah, we formed a little filmmaking society and made some pretty unimpressive things, and one good thing, which was Lenny's short film Three Joes, which featured Gary Cook,
exactly,
and Dominic West, and the brilliant Irish performer Michael Murphy, MikeelMurphy. That one,
yes,
and that actually kind of did make an impression internationally. It sort of won, you know, prizes at kind of good film festivals internationally. And that was the first time we did something that kind of just meant something outside of our own little circle, if that makes sense.
No, but I mean, again, look, just talk us through. I know it's a long journey, but it's important for people to get the context that, you know, you're making movies in the 90s. It's incredibly difficult to actually get the money to try and get anybody interested. There's no hinterland in Irish movies. There's no credibility. You're coming, you know. Explain to me what that was like before everything started to sort of fall into place.
Well, the Irish Film Board did exist in the 80s and supported, you know, Neil Jordan and Jim Sheridan in making their first films. And then it was cut in some round of cuts by, I'm not sure which government at the time. So it wasn't like there was nothing, but there was a kind of a start, and then the rug got pulled. And Jim and Neil at that point were kind of off to the races. They had established their careers and they were working internationally. And I do remember, you know, very well, I guess it must have been 89 or 90 when My Left Foot got a whole bunch of nominations and wins for Daniel Day-Lewis and Brenda Fricker. And I remember that being a kind of a very inspirational moment, like when you could see, like, you know, Jim and, you know, I knew a lot of people who worked on that film, and, you know, that made it feel like, gosh, there is something possible here. And the other thing that happened around that time is that a lot of my contemporaries, including Paddy Burnock, who I still work with, who directed a show called The Dry, we have coming out on Lenny Abrahamson, and, you know, a bunch of people were making short films at quite a high standard without any money, but kind of spontaneously. And there was a gang of us, including Damien O'Donnell and John Moore and people like that, all went on to do great work. And we would work on each other's short films. You know, this is late 80s, early 90s. And the stuff was good and it was winning at festivals, et cetera, et cetera. So for some reason, there was a kind of an appetite amongst, you know, people to start making things. Like, we were trying to make stuff and make it at a reasonable standard. And that coincided with the reestablishment of the Irish Film Board by Michael D. Higgins in, I think, 93. And so we were, you know, just starting off when the Film Board was reestablished. And that just meant that there was actually money there for the first time. And that sort of was, you know, incredibly important. And so many of us have grown up with that support, you know, with the Film Board support. And had that not been reestablished, I don't know, I suppose we would have all moved abroad and maybe done it elsewhere.
Yeah, no, because I remember you gave me a ring. You gave me a call about 1998 or 99, and you said, look, we need some economics reports here. We need to yeah. move this one. And you said, yeah. What do you know about film finance? I said, I don't know anything about it. And you said, look, I'll tell you it all. And do you remember we wrote that report, I think it was 99.
Yes.
And to try and preserve what became Section 481.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think that was about sort of trying to make the kind of economic arguments as well as the cultural ones, you know, sort of. And I think what is true now, I think, you know, whatever, 30 years on, as you say, is that the kind of validity of the film industry or film and television industry as something that's culturally important, that's economically important, that's commercially important, that actually makes sense. That, I think, that argument has largely been won. I don't think anyone would dispute that particularly. But back in those days, in the mid to late 90s, it was very, very fragile. So although there was a bit of money there, I guess you were kind of trying to justify it, not only in its cultural terms, but also in those other ones as well. And as I say, I think that battle is largely being won.
So, okay, Ed, bring us up to now. We have an industry. Give me the big trends from the industry. Give me the position of Ireland and give me what you think is the sort of vision of the future of the industry in Ireland.
Well, I think it's quite a tough time in the international industry at the moment. We're coming off a kind of what was peak TV, which was sort of coincided, I suppose. I mean, it was growing on the way up to the pandemic, but actually really crystallized there in a way because so many people were kind of signing on to Netflixes and all this kind of stuff because they had free time. And the big dynamic with Disney and Netflix and all of the streamers was to get subscribers, was to get people to sign on. So that led to a kind of a content boom, which didn't necessarily ultimately make a hell of a lot of sense financially. And subsequently, a lot of the streamers have realized actually that they're kind of just constantly making new things in order to get subscribers. They feel no longer is justified. In a way, also Netflix has kind of pulled away from the rest of them and is by far the kind of the strongest of the streamers. So we're actually in a moment now where, you know, the amount of television drama that's been made has, you know, been cut quite a lot. And also cinema is now recovering from the pandemic, but obviously cinemas were, you know, really badly hit by the pandemic. So they're positive signs in cinemas, particularly last year when you see the Barbenheimer phenomenon and indeed our own Poor Things and a bunch of movies that actually, you know, people were going to see and were doing very well at the cinema. So it's kind of, I think we can say sort of cinema is back or was back at the end of last year. But the other dynamic that was going on, again, people maybe have heard about this, was a big actor's strike and a big writer's strike last year. And that actually meant that nothing was made for months, which now means that there's a shortage of product. So,
Right. You
know, in our cinemas, we're looking at this year and just going, well, like, what are we going to program in a way that we've never had to think about that before? So there's a lot of kind of storm clouds and squalls, and the industry is internationally under a lot of kind of dynamics that are not necessarily very positive. But the one thing that I think, you know, that endures is there is absolutely a demand audiences want to see good work. Absolutely. Yeah. That absolutely endures. And again, I think, you know, the recent success of those films that I mentioned, I think, makes that point. But there is a kind of market failure at the moment as the streamers retrench, as, you know, distributors who were badly hit during the pandemic are just trying to figure themselves out. Cinemas are closing down. So I think at the heart of it, there is absolutely a demand. And I feel very positive about that looking into the future. There's absolutely demand for high quality film and television content. And in a way, maybe doing less, but doing it better is not a bad thing. You know, like I think there was a sense that lots of stuff got made, but actually the quality was incredibly variable. You know, there were some great things, but there's a lot of dross. So I think that there's maybe a kind of a little bit of, you know, survival of the fittest as we move forward, which isn't a bad thing at all. And a bit more quality control, if you like. And I suppose when we look to the future as Element, like what we do is we don't do Marvel movies or, you know, Star Wars movies. Where we exist is in I guess, what's called the smart house world, which is specialty, smart house, prestige, whatever you want to call it, where we make films that kind of primarily are distributed by the likes of Searchlight, which is owned by Disney in the States, or A24, which is another studio in the States. And they're kind of, I suppose they're the kinds of films that would be a little bit outsidery, kind of hopefully awards contenders, very director-driven, more authored, less dependent on kind of shiny IP, you know, and I would say less derivative, generally stuff that's kind of more original and people are taking big swings in terms of like the boldness of the material. And I think if you look at the last few years, if you look at Parasite winning Best Picture at the Oscars, if you look at last year, Everything Ever All at Once, you look at Oppenheimer, which let's face it, is a 3-hour, quite slow, quite ponderous, you know, story about the man who invented the atom bomb. Like it's not an obvious one. And yet it nearly did $1 billion and the phenomenon that is Barbie. So you're kind of seeing actually the stuff that's succeeding in the cinema now is the stuff that's a bit different and bold. And that gives me great heart going forwards. And that's the business we are in and we want to continue to be in, which is making kind of, I suppose, ambitious, authored material that's audience facing that, you know, we can put out into the world.
Ed, can I ask you about Ireland? Because Ireland is always, you know, very much we're trying to attract in industry, we're trying to attract in money as a general rule. You know, it's the small country dilemma. You just don't have the capital market and you don't have this huge pool of talent. You've nodes of talent and you've little groups and gangs, but as a general rule, you're still competing. And what is always the case in Ireland is we've always got this conflict, whether it's in economics or it's manufacturing, whether it's in tech and whether it's in culture and cinema, between what I call the factory model and the creative model. So the factory model is we give tax breaks, come on in, build your factories here, build your, you know, in the TV production side, build your production facilities here. But you know what? The talent doesn't necessarily have to come up from here. And it's a sort of a volume game, right? And then there's the other side of Ireland, which is that the deep well of creative storytelling here, which is really where the cream is on the top of the bottle. It's really where the value is. But yet sometimes we don't have the confidence to back ourselves and we go for the volume. So it's a wee bit like, you know, when the multinationals came in, we said, don't worry about IP, don't worry about research, just make the shit here. And then we'll give you a tax break and you'll give us jobs. And I see something similar in the creative space. So kind of explain that to me and where you think we might be going.
I mean, I think that's really true. I think that is the case. I think that there is a kind of a dual sort of industry in the sense that you put it well, the kind of, let's call it the factory, and I call it the indigenous, but, you know, it's sort of the offshore, the indigenous. But I think that we have sort of been over-reliant on, in terms of growing the industry here and bringing in big shows from abroad to basically just locate here and be made here. And listen, there is absolutely a place for that. I'm very supportive of it. It provides great employment. It provides, you know, lots of opportunities for people to move up, you know, from a junior position to a more senior position and earn their wings and all that kind of stuff. Like, it is positive in lots of ways, but it's also very vulnerable. It's very vulnerable to exchange rates. It's very vulnerable to what we're seeing, which is to the downturn in the international industry, which we're seeing now. So just there's less stuff being made. it's very vulnerable to what tax breaks exist in other territories. So you can keep tweaking your tax break to make it more or less competitive. And the other thing is that it obviously employs people, but it doesn't really leave anything behind in terms of, you know, there's no ownership left behind. Yeah. They come, they make it, and they leave. And I strongly feel that if we want to build an industry here and take advantage of, you know, we've had a great run, you know, recently. And I suppose going back to, I don't know, when John Carney's film once got an Oscar nomination, you know, that was a wow.
That was a big deal. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it was. And then we had Room in Brooklyn another year. And, you know, like we've, over the last decade or so, we've been consistently turning up, you know, at the top table. And for a tiny country like Ireland, it is kind of surprising that that is the case. But I think if we want to build on that potential and we want to grow into the future, what we need to do is look at how we can own the stories, how we can own the IP. And I think what we need to do is invest in really the R&D, which is development, script writing, storytelling, empowering our writers, giving them experience. That's actually where the future is going to be. Because the point is, if you own the IP and you've generated it, then you can go out into the world and say, you're not asking for permission. You're saying, we're making this thing. Do you want to come on board?
Yeah, do you want to be part of it?
Yeah. And you know, not to pat ourselves on the back, but Normal People is a very good example of that. You know, when Sally agreed for Lenny to direct that and, you know, BBC backed us, we were able to go out into the world and say, well, we're making this thing. Does anyone want to buy it? And Hulu in America bought for America, et cetera. And it sold all over the world. And that's something that still is, you know, that resides with all of us, the people who made it. I feel like we're all partners in that project, all of us. And that is the future. And that is, as I say, about elevating the art and craft of screen storytelling.
Ed, I just want to ask you about the craft side of the industry and how that has changed over the years and what Ireland has to offer. Because, you know, when you look at, for instance, the impact of the internet and good internet connection and AI and all that kind of stuff, how that has kind of diluted the craft. Because you can send stuff anywhere in the world. There's some brilliant post-production houses like Screen Scene and GABA and all those. They're battling against post-production houses in, you know, India and Thailand and around the world. How has that affected the kind of whole filmmaking process and the kind of Irish identity in that craft side of things?
Mind you, I mean, from what I know, they're really holding their own, like the Irish. Mm. For Oscar week, there's a whole sort of trade mission component to that. And there's an event called the Oscar Wild Awards, which is, you know, a couple of days before the Oscars, which is to honor kind of Irish people working in the film and television industry. And there were a lot of people from, you know, Screen Scene and Windmill and all that. They were all out in force and they were going to the studios and, you know, selling their wares. And there's great expertise there. I mean, it's a craft, but also there's great expertise in the kind of the visual effects teams in those places. Yeah. And they're doing brilliant work. I think, you know, AI, and I'm no expert on it, but it is definitely going to change things in our business in the way that it will in every business, and it will have a radical impact. I suppose it's even more reason to kind of invest in the things that maybe AI can't do, which is
exactly.
Originality, creativity. You know, AI is great at replicating and feeding off what pre-exists, but actually, you know, the future is really about great new bold ideas, and that, you know, it's certainly at this point can only come from human beings. So again, I think, you know, we're kind of future-proofing ourselves by investing in kind of human capacity, human creativity in its purest form, and back to the whole point around storytelling.
And in this regard, this week you have a festival. Yeah. So tell me, because the festivals of screenwriting, and again, when I'm going back, you know, I'm going back a few years, if you'd said, oh, we're going to put on a festival of, you know, screenwriting in Dublin, people are like, yeah, really? You know, and yet you've got a festival coming up this weekend, starting Thursday the 21st. Tell me about this and tell me about what you hope to achieve, who's coming, what the vibe is.
Yeah, I mean, so it's something that I've been thinking about doing for literally years and years, and really in a way kind of predicated on what I just said there, which is actually, you know, in the beginning is the word, like we just have to invest in that. That's what it's all about. And also, I guess, you know, there is this thing of like Ireland being a nation of storytellers. And actually, although it's a cliche, it's also sort of true. I mean, you know it, you see it in, I don't need to tell you about your own festival, like, the power of Irish, and you know, fiction literature. It's unbelievable. You know, even like a few days ago, Paul Murray winning that, you know, that prize, and it just it keeps on going. Like, it's extraordinary and hard to explain, but it's there. And of course, theater similarly, like, you know, the impression that Irish realms have made in the world of theater. Music, I don't need to tell you about either, which is a form of storytelling. It's absolutely, you know, it's just a different version of it. Animation, you know, the likes of Cartoon Saloon, who've been doing incredible work over the years. And then the kind of more live action film and television. And I suppose the thing about Storyhouse, which is what we're calling the festival, is about trying to bring the best international screenwriters to Dublin. And these are people that would be in our network that we kind of know, and we can kind of twist their arm a little bit with a nice few days in Dublin and all that kind of stuff, but bring them to Dublin, but to talk candidly about their process, to sort of talk about, you know, where they come from, the joys and challenges of how you create really good work, about how you have to dig deep in order to do it. You have to reiterate again and again. You have to go, you know, rewrite, redraft, all of that stuff. And I feel for Irish people who are thinking about a career in the film industry, you know, in whatever capacity, but I think to hear directly from successful people internationally is really powerful, because in a way we have too many kind of script gurus and courses on development and this and the other, that, and it's a bit industrialized, and I want to get rid of that and just try and have a direct conversation, you know, from the horse's mouth, so to speak, you know, people talking to the audience and hopefully inspiring them and empowering them and emboldening them. Because of all of these people, you know, we've say Tony McNamara, who wrote Poor Things, you know, Tony started off in theater, he wrote television. He came out of a wave of, you know, Australian creative talent, including, I guess, Kate Blanchett, you know, a number of people at that time. But Tony just, he's the most extraordinary writer, but he works really hard, you know, and he takes these risks. And, you know, we also have David Nichols, who's an extraordinary screenwriter and novelist. Most recent success is his book, One Day, to be readapted by Netflix. We have two brilliant young British filmmakers, Molly Manning-Walker and Charlotte Regan, who have just made their first films, Molly, How to Have Sex, and Charlotte, Scrapper. And they're going to do a panel together about how you make your first film. Both of those films have done really well. They both were nominated Best British Film this year at the BAFTAs. These are young women just talking about their process, how they can actually... I'm certain Kate Dolan, a young Irish filmmaker, is going to interview them. And I'm certain that there'll be people in the audience who will be inspired by their story. Nancy Harris is going to do a deep dive on The Dry, the show that we're just about, the second season of that is about to go out in the UK and hopefully here in Ireland soon. Which is a wonderful show we're very proud of. And that'll be a deep dive in the development of that, how you kind of build the first season and then you try and replicate it again. And the second season of The Dry just got 5 stars in The Guardian, you know, so it's formed in a really
and
good way.
And it's the idea of saying it's kind of looking at the mechanics, the nuts and bolts, because
Because
you have all these courses saying, you know, scriptwriting courses, maybe given for people with great intentions and you know, really, really the best intentions, but maybe not having the experience of actually, I had an idea, I sat down, I wrote it, I got a producer, we got some money, we went from here to there, but then we put out a pilot and somebody liked the pilot. It is kind of miraculous that any of this stuff gets made. It is miraculous when you think about the amount of things. And just finally then, so Thursday and Friday, the weekend is all storytelling. It's all cinema. It's, where is it? Where can people even?
It's taking place at the Lighthouse. And we may not have many tickets left, but if there are, we'll put them back up on socials and on the website. But we're looking forward to it.
Ed, what's the website?
It's storyhouseireland.com.
Well, listen, Ed, listen. Again, from those very strange beginnings, November 1987, the Irish football team, unlikely qualifiers, Irish lads, unlikely movie makers, and here we are, Oscar winners. Wonderful story, Ed. Listen, great to talk to you.
Congrats.
Lovely to see you.
Thank you. Thanks, Damon. Thanks, JD. Thank you.
See you shortly.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states.
United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Oh, that was good. I enjoyed talking to Ed. Yeah. Really interesting stuff. But actually, I just say this, and I've gone a little aside. Do you remember I did loads of movies? I used to work with Michael Kamen years ago doing soundtracks. But one of the soundtracks we did was Roadhouse, which was a big movie of its time. Was it about 89, 90, something like that, with Patrick Swayze.
And it wasn't Dirty Dancing, John, I can see you. I can see you doing it now.
It wasn't a great movie, but it was kind of a cult following. But I just heard that they're doing a remake of it with Jake Gyllenhaal. I don't know why you'd remake something like that. But do you know who's in it?
Who?
Fucking Conor McGregor.
Irish soft power.
There you go.
Proper 12, isn't it? What's his name?
I have no idea.
Proper 12, isn't it?
This just is beating people up. That's
beating people up. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's again, that is another version of it. But, you know, what I get most out of the conversation with Ed is it can be done. That's the key.
Yeah.
So you can imagine the late 80s and the early 90s where there's moments of success, but there's no sense of an industry. And now we've got an industry that's worth €500 million a year. So how is it done? And this is when you say you can't do things, you can do things. Also, it demands a number of people to be unreasonable. Like it was an unreasonable thing for Ed to say to me in 88, right? I'm going to make movies.
Yeah.
Because at the time, everyone says, oh my God, I've got to go to London to get a job. Or, oh my God, I've got to become an accountant. Well, or, oh my God, you know, because we did economics in school, right? Yeah. Or in college, right? Yeah. So everyone says, oh my God, I have to go and work in the civil service. There's two jobs in the civil service, right? And he said, no.
Did you say to him, like, Ed, I think you're being unreasonable?
I said, you're being absolutely unreasonable. It was like me saying, after Ireland qualified, I think I'd be playing up front for Ireland in the Euros, right? It was as ludicrous as that. Much as for deep inside, I felt, naturally, I should be there wearing the number 9, push over Frank Stapleton. But the point is, it can be done.
Yeah.
And it is being done. So when you think a country doesn't have the right to play amongst the big boys, yes, it does. But it requires application. Yes, government support. Yes, energy and vision and unusual people. And as I say, you know, the world is made better by unreasonable people. By people who say no, people who are cussed, people who say, no, we can do it this way. And it can be done. And the Irish film industry is an example of that. And on St. Patrick's Day, isn't it kind of amazing that all over the world, people are reading Irish scripts, watching Irish actors, and actually getting a sense, and it doesn't even have to be an Irish movie, but it's a sense that this country is part of a global conversation, which is what St. Patrick's Day is all about. So go and have your shamrocks there and your shillelaghs and your carry-on, and I will talk to you on Thursday.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.